All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, May 4th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is a warm and humid 60 degrees and overcast here in upstate New York. And we have had a couple really nice days. I actually got out and planted some vegetables this week, so it was nice. So where do we leave off last Friday? Sorry I wasn't here on Wednesday. We titled the show Fort Detrick, Germs, DARPA, Harvard, MIT, Gene and Organoid Engineering. And we had looked at some disturbing things, kind of started back in Fort Detrick, Maryland. They were doing a lot of the biowarfare research, initially in a defensive posture and then in an offensive posture after the inking of that agreement for us to not develop chemical or biological warfare products anymore by Richard Nixon. We're going to dig a little bit more into biowarfare and some of the really disturbing things that I've uncovered in the last week in doing some reading. I read another book or two, and a bunch of different articles on some very strange immunological things that were developed in the past. We found that there was an involvement not only by the U.S. government working at Fort Detrick, but also back to World War II. If you look at the history of the germ warfare programs, you find out that Germany was very big into germ warfare, as was Japan. Not only germ warfare, but testing it on human subjects. A lot of those captured Chinese. And at the end of the war, we swooped in and took our side of the German scientists and took the stuff that the Japanese had been working on and brought all that back here to the United States to further our biological warfare programs. And then Nixon inked that agreement, and we said, whoops, we can't do that anymore. We are going to convert Fort Detrick into, quote-unquote, cancer research, wink, where they continued not only cancer research, and we found out a lot of the cancer research utilizing nanotechnology and different synthetic proteins and DNA technologies, CRISPR technologies, where they are utilizing 21st century cures to target different biological systems in the body and different surfaces, protein surfaces on the cells. And remember, it's always a double-edged sword, because as these crack all these different little secrets, they not only discover how to cure you, but to kill you. And then let's hand it over to artificial intelligence. That's one of my big worries. Now, there was a story that I never got to the other day when we were talking about gene editing, nanotechnologies, and this type of thing. It's titled Laboratory Automation, Robots for Life Sciences, April 19th, 2018. When we first read about the incredible potential of nanotechnology as described in Engines of Creation, and that was Eric Drexler's book, and I linked to that a couple days ago, but I can link to that again. The only thing that we could think of was how to invest in it. I didn't. The potential for molecular machines or nanobots, they'll be made out of some of your own cells, could be programmed to do just about anything, and it sounded limitless, and we wanted in on the ground floor as investors. That was back in 2003 when G.W. Bush signed the Nanotechnology Research and Development Act, but since then, things have seemed to fail miserably, and I would tend to disagree with that. We actually found out that there's an institute and there's all kinds of funding going on. Carbon nanotubes did not do jack, though they've been doing a lot of that with putting them into cells and then heating them up with ultrasound and things of that nature. And other nanomaterials like graphene have resulted in some expensive sporting equipment, but that's a little upside for investors so far. But more noticeably, the prefix nano and the word nanotechnology have all but disappeared. But the ideas haven't, and I would disagree with that as well, but whatever. Scientists are now using technologies like gene editing and laboratory automation to build synthetic organisms that do cool things like quote-unquote sweat biofuel. And in fact, mad science got mad. There are now companies like Ginkgo Bioworks that use lab automation to produce thousands of new prototype organisms for their clients. We first visited this topic back in 2016 when we wrote about three companies building nanorobot factories. We talked about how these new synthetic organisms sound very much like the nanobots that we have been waiting for, or not. And more recently, we visited the topic and pointed out that Ginkgo Bioworks was likely to reach a $1 billion valuation. And indeed, they achieved unicorn status just days later, an event that was probably equal parts encouraging and discouraging for the four other players in this space. The automated production of organisms, not be designed synthetic organisms, that serve humans is made possible by something called laboratory automation or lab automation. And companies like Ginkgo Bioworks and Zymergen use it in-house to build alien organisms. And that is just one application of lab automation that we call in-house. And there's something better described as lab automation in the cloud, which we've talked about some of this before. This cloud is going to be the big eye in the sky. We first talked about it a few years back in an article titled Emerald Therapeutics, a robotic laboratory in the cloud. And that is where anyone but anyone on the planet can run experiments on expensive laboratory equipment that lives in the cloud. So it's not just going to be things bought off of eBay anymore in mommy's garage. You can just chuck it up to the cloud and get used. So this is where anyone, just anyone, can run experiments on expensive laboratory equipment that live in the cloud. And this type of lab automation makes an entire laboratory available to aspiring scientists who don't have the capital needed to purchase expensive life sciences equipment. So what's been happening with Emerald Therapeutics since we last looked? Well, not a whole lot yet. They have changed their name to Emerald Cloud Lab and deployed a nice new website which provides a slick walkthrough on how their technology works alongside a roadmap for future technologies. It's a lot of technical mumbo jumbo. It looks like the company is expanding and hiring, but they're being very tight-lipped about their progress, which could mean some sort of liquidity event is nigh, or they could be playing their cards close to their chest since there's another company out there offering, quote, a robotic cloud laboratory for life sciences. Founded in 2012, San Francisco startup Transcriptic has taken $27.8 million so far to develop what looks like to be the exact same sort of offering as Emerald Therapeutics. And one similarity between the two startups is that they both share some of the same investors like Peter Thiel. And there's also a venture capital firm called Data Collective. Oh yeah, I gotta love that. Become a Borg with your gene data in the cloud. Who liked the idea of lab automation so much that they were a lead investor in both laboratory automation startups and the aforementioned Ginkgo Bioworks, which tells us something. Transcriptic was in the news this past week when Ginkgo Bioworks and Transcriptic received $9.5 million in grants from who? Oh, DARPA! So they could throw some machine learning into the mix. And the people who are helping DARPA with their machine learning was Google, if you remember back from a few shows ago. That is not the first time that these two companies will be working together. Back in October of last year, Ginkgo Bioworks and Transcriptic entered into a five-year agreement that was valued at $10 million, which involved Ginkgo incorporating Transcriptic's cutting-edge robotic automation software into its Boston-based foundries. If I remember correctly, those foundries for developing synthetic organisms were being run by the Weiss Institute, maybe, or what was the other one that Georgie Porgy Church was involved in? There were two of them up there. It was Weiss and one of their other connecting organizations, but you know what I mean. They got money from DARPA to create a Living Foundries as part of the Living Foundries project. Anyway, remember that Ginkgo Bioworks is a billion-dollar company that has taken $429 million in funding. And in fact, they made the statement that Transcriptic is a pretty solid vote of confidence. And this doesn't mean that Transcriptic might be involved toward moving their marketing tech to an in-house lab automation, while Emerald will focus on lab automation in the cloud. But who knows? Transcriptic is being more open, so who really cares? Anyway, blah, 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 blah. So that just illustrates the horror of what we are facing right now with things such as CRISPR becoming a weapon of mass destruction, as claimed by Eric Clapper. And we have to really wonder some of the things that they are doing, not only in government laboratories, but I'm telling you, Big Pharma has been involved for a very long time. I had mentioned a discovery when I was reading that book called Biology of Doom. And one of the things they had talked about was in the very beginnings of the biowarfare program in the United States. And this was during World War II, like I mentioned, and it was happening across the globe in all of the big countries, including in Europe and England and Japan and Germany. They were all working on biowarfare agents. So here's a story, September 17, 2017, out of Heather Callaghan's publication, Natural Blaze. Merck's president led a biological warfare program against Americans. Merck and company created the HPV vaccine Gardasil, the MMR vaccine, and many others. And during the peak of World War II, George W. Merck, president of Merck and Company, was in charge of the War Research Service, which was the biological warfare division of the larger federal security agency. Merck led the biological warfare department for almost a half a decade, and during those same years, he was president of Merck and Company, and his trusting customers had no idea that he was also in charge of a secret biowarfare program. His War Research Service was in charge of Fort Detrick, Maryland, and dozens of academic institutions in the U.S. participated in the War Research Service, and those same prestigious institutions that promoted eugenics during the decades leading up to World War II, such as Harvard and Stanford. Fort Detrick was a center of mad science that would culminate into biological warfare experiments on Americans, things such as spraying San Francisco with infertility-causing bacteria called Serratia marsicans. And their techniques were improved with the aid of paperclip scientists, like I had mentioned, after the end of World War II. And that would include scientist Kurt Blohm. Kurt Blohm, and there's actually a big Wikipedia entry about Kurt Blohm. I ran across him a long time ago. Kurt Blohm was brought to the United States from Nazi Germany to work at Fort Detrick, and he previously experimented on victims with Black Death and bubonic plague. So, all right, where do we go from here? So I ran across a couple documents. Actually, here's another one. This one has got to make you wonder about things. So we got Merck's president working as the head of the biological warfare at Fort Detrick. They also brought some Nazi scientists over to work over there. But now we also have Billy Gates, who's talking to Trump. This just came out a few days back, April 30th, 2018. Bill Gates got President Trump fired up about a universal flu vaccine and also maybe got a job offer. What? That would be a nightmare. We know that DARPA has been working on their shape-shifting immune system, which started as the universal flu vaccine program, and I think that initially was called Blue Angel. Back from like 2006, I had learned about that. So this is out of Stat, statnews.com. Bill Gates was talking to President Trump in the Oval Office last month when the conversation turned to the notion of a universal flu vaccine. Probably, as Gates recalled in an interview, the longest conversation about a universal flu vaccine that the president has ever had. Unquote. You should associate yourself with American innovation. Wouldn't you love to have the universal flu vaccine be something that really got kicked off and energized by you, Gates recalls, asking Trump, of course, inflating his ego. The idea fired up Trump, who Gates described as quote-unquote super interested. And in the matter of moments, Trump had Scott Gottlieb, who is the commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, on the speakerphone asking him about a vaccine that could generate lasting protection against a range of seasonal and animal flu viruses with pandemic potential. Hey, Gates says that there is a universal flu vaccine. Is that crazy? Says Gates, recalling the president asking of the FDA. And Gates said Gottlieb confessed that while he had heard that there was some very good work underway, he wasn't an expert and would need to look into it. Yes, like a good politician. The flu vaccine discussion, an unexpected job offer from Trump, some criticism from a previous president, and an explanation from Gates on why he chose global health philanthropy over political spending. A team of journalists from Stats sat down on Friday in Boston for a freewheeling discussion with the head of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and also got a sense of how steeped he has become in matters involving vaccines, pandemics, and public health. Yeah, rubbing his hands together. Hey, Bill Gates, do you want a new job? Well, Trump has not named anyone yet to fill the vacant post of the White House science advisor, but the last director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, John Holdren, resigned at the end of the Obama administration. Many in the scientific community are worried about this vacancy, and Gates brought it up during his 40 minutes a meeting with Trump. Oh, no. Gates says, I mentioned, hey, maybe we should have a science advisor. And I asked, and? And he said, did I want to be the science advisor? Oh, my God. That is not the answer that Gates was looking for. He says, that is not a good use of my time. He recalls telling the president, yes, so he turned him down. Gates admitted that he doesn't know what would have happened if he said yes, but I didn't put him to the test whether that was a serious thing or not, and he probably himself didn't know if I was serious. It was a friendly thing, and I was being friendly. Gates has met Trump 3 times since 2016. During the first 2 meetings, they had multiple topics such as foreign aid, educations, and vaccines. And this time, the conversation was later focused on global health security. And it may be a hard sell at the White House, given that Trump has repeatedly said that the U.S. has been spending far too much money abroad. But Gates, who argues that pandemics have no borders, cast his message in a way that he hoped might speak to Trump. Quote, one thing is for sure, no matter what your framework, even if it is that the human benefits outside of the country count for zero, stopping pandemics are a good thing. And the capacity to build the tools that would help you be prepared for a big pandemic, and the U.S. is really the only country that has got a broad set of those tools, but even totally nationalistic framework, you don't want a lot of Americans to die from a flu or smallpox or some new wink pathogen like one created in these cloud laboratories, I'm going to add. And speaking of smallpox, this deadly virus appears to weigh on Gates' mind, even though it was declared eradicated in 1980. And don't let me forget, because I got a story that I did not pull up. Damn. You know what? Hold on 1 second. Because I wanted to find it. I mentioned it was before. It was about a horsepox, I believe, that scientists have been tinkering with. Let me get to my page. I might have to sing. Nope, hold on. It's just horrifying, some of these things that they're doing. Also, there was another story queued up about scientists accidentally creating an enzyme in the lab that eats plastic. So don't worry about that big plastic island. Yeah, here it is. I'll pull it up. Don't worry about that big plastic island floating in the Pacific Ocean. We'll just put our mutant protein that we accidentally created in the lab on it. It'll fix it all up. It's just nuts. What if that enzyme starts eating human flesh at some point because we have part plastic particulates in it? All right, so let's get back to where I was on Stats interview with Billy Gates. So anyway, says stopping pandemics is a smart thing. in the cases of new pathogen, deadly viruses, speaking of smallpox, are weighing on Gates' mind, even though smallpox was declared eradicated in 1980. In a speech in Boston on Friday, Gates several times raised the specter of potential bioterrorism attacks using smallpox. And let me just jump over here because I think this may be the reason. January 23rd, 2018, Gizmodo magazine, scientists slammed for synthesizing a smallpox-like virus in the lab. The dreaded smallpox virus was eradicated more than 40 years ago, but the threat of its return still looms. And in an effort to develop a safer vaccine substitute, Canadian researchers have resurrected a close relative, which was the extinct horsepox virus, from scratch. Critics say the exercise was pointless because the results were published in an open access journal, and now they fear, whoops, that the smallpox virus can be manufactured by virtually anybody, terrorists included, maybe even using one of those virtual cloud laboratories. Researchers from the University of Alberta revived the horsepox virus by referencing a publicly available genome sequence, and then by chemically manufacturing DNA fragments from scratch. They said that this is the very first complete synthesis of a pox virus, which is a family of nearly 70 known viruses that include smallpox, cowpox, and horsepox, and that is the largest virus ever assembled using chemically synthesized DNA. News of this work first emerged in July 2017, with the publication of the results of in an open access journal called PLOS-1 on January of 2018 has sparked a fresh wave of concern. And some critics now say that the research was unnecessary as safe and effective vaccines for smallpox already exist. I actually got that vaccine when my mother was taking me on a trip and they insisted that I get it at that time. Because I think that was pre-1980s. Because the recipe for horsepox was made available online, there's a general concern now that the technique could get into the wrong hands. And if you can synthesize a horsepox virus, you can pretty much synthesize any virus in the pox family, including variola, which is responsible for the smallpox virus. Smallpox is now contained, but it was responsible for outbreaks in the 18th century that killed around 400,000 Europeans annually, and approximately 300 to 500 million people worldwide in the 20th century. Horsepox went extinct on its own, but like cowpox, it is harmless to humans. But now they want to explore the virus for possible protective effects, and acquiring samples wasn't possible. The CDC, which safeguards samples of horsepox, did not hand it over, so they had to make their own version. Now, how lunatic is that? So, all right, let's now jump to the meat and potatoes of the show. Some of these PDFs that I ran across over the last week. First one was written by Michael J. Anscoff, who is a colonel in the U.S. Air Force. And this was part of a counterproliferation paper for future warfare series. This would be U.S. Air Force Counterproliferation Center, titled Next Generation Bioweapons, the Technology of Genetic Engineering Applied to Biowarfare and Bioterrorism. Now, it was rainy here over the last 24 hours or so I went out to Netflix, took a look around, and I ran across a series titled Helix. I don't know if anyone out there actually got to see any of the episodes, but it was pretty decent. And it had to do with a lot of these different things. It was a laboratory way, way, way up in the Arctic that was quite advanced, but it was outside of the regions of any one country's control. And they were funded by a large pharmaceutical company, and they were doing research that wasn't allowed in any other country, utilizing highly virulent viruses, some of which were genetically engineered to create first wink a cure for cancer, maybe some other diseases, targeting your RNA and your DNA, and then mutating. I don't know what the whole point of it was, but I'm telling you, it was utilizing a lot of these technologies that we've been looking at. So anyway, this next generation bioweapons, the technology of genetic engineering applied to biowarfare and bioterrorism, was dated, and this is the shocking part, April of 2002. So we're talking 16 years ago, and trust me, they have gotten a very long way since this document was inked. We are probably going to start at section 2 that was titled The Former Soviet Union's Biological Warfare Program, and we found that I'm having a senior moment. But one of the virologists, animal and crop virologists that we looked at, maybe I'll remember his name. Oh, we just mentioned the other day, had specialized in the Soviet biowarfare program. Despite the signing of the 1972 Biological and Toxic Weapons Convention, this is one I've talked about before, that Nixon inked, it is now certain that the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, continued a clandestine and illegal offensive biological weapons program at least until the early 1990s. Biopreparat is what it was called, and there was a huge military program with a civilian cover, kind of like our CDC, and the now current for Dietrich Cancer Research was organized to develop and weaponize biological agents for biological warfare. It employed approximately half of the Soviet Union's 60,000 workers and more than 18 biological warfare facilities. And in the 1980s, had an annual budget equivalent to tens of millions of U.S. dollars. Unlike the Americans' offensive biological weapons program, where they were making vaccines, they worked primarily with organisms that were not contagious in humans, and that would be things like anthrax and tularemia. And the Soviet Biological Research and Development Program also sought out the most contagious and lethal bacteria such as plague and viruses such as smallpox known to man. Because the biopreparats and other Soviet biowarfare research facilities operated under the high security classifications of special importance, and that would be even a higher level than top secret, the U.S. intelligence community did not even know it existed until 1989, when a top-ranking scientist from the Biological Warfare Program defected to the United Kingdom. From his extensive debrief and subsequent collaboration with two other defectors from the program, we now know detailed information on the genetic engineering successes and other advances in Russian microbiology. Obviously, much of the data remains classified, but three of the defectors' accounts have been documented to some extent in various unclassified books and articles. And this paper discusses these open source accounts. In October 1989, Dr. Vladimir Pashinik, the first primary source from inside the Soviet program, defected to England. A top Soviet microbiologist and director of the Institute for Ultra-Pure Biological Preparations in Bioreparat, he described the extensive organization of biological research and the production facilities in the Russian program. In addition to confirming that the Soviet Union had an offensive biowarfare program in violation of the 1972 Biological Warfare Convention, he also disclosed that the Soviets had a, quote, extensive genetic engineering program aimed to develop new kinds of biological weapons against which the West would be completely defenseless. What? This, and so do we, of course. This institute's top priority was to increase the lethality of plagues and tularemia, and at the very same time, make them more resilient to antibiotics and temperature extremes. By introducing specially engineered plasmids, and I think those are bacteria or, those are infections that infect viruses into successive generations of tularemia cultures. The strain became resistant to all known Western antibiotics. The dried powdery super plague became the Soviet weapon of choice, and it was loaded onto various munitions, and that would be bombs and things. And the use of the biological warfare had been integrated into Soviet special war plans from a range of tactical operations where they would have been delivered using spray tanks and other cluster bombs and strategic operations with intercontinental ballistic missiles. And strategic bombs would be carrying plague, anthrax, or smallpox. Remember, we talked about the U.S. working on programs of that nature as well. Pasternak also detailed work on perfecting new strains of bacteria and viruses that would aerosolize well for use in weapons. And after 30 years of experimentation, Soviet scientists had solved the problem of fragile microbe survival in major atmospheric pressure changes and temperature extremes during missile flight by fitting biological rockets with astronaut-like cabins that were protective. They solved the destruction on explosion problem by selecting the hardiest strains and calculating the requirements for redundant quality needed to base on explosive testing in Bioprepart and other bioresearch labs. In summary, Pasternak had disclosed that the Soviets had genetically engineered bacteria and viruses, had weaponized the microbes in powder form, and had loaded them onto various munitions, as well as integrated biological warfare into their doctrine and had specific plans for use, which is very frightening. In the spring of 1992, a lower-level bench scientist who had worked on plague with Pasternak had also defected to the United Kingdom, and he remained undercover and is referred to by codename Temple Fortune. He fully corroborated Pasternak's previous account and then updated the British on the Soviet biowarfare work in the last 30-month intervals since Pasternak's departure. President Mikhail Gorbachev had ordered the termination of biological offensives in 1990, and despite the fact that Yeltsin had also announced termination of the program, new research on forms of plague had actually secretly continued. Like, wouldn't you know it? Just like it has here. I don't know with plague, but there's all kinds of things going on in our labs. I could guarantee it. Temple Fortune said that in addition to being even more resistant to multiple antibiotics, this new and improved super plague would be non-virulent in its stored form, but it could easily be converted into a deadly antibiotic-resistant form if it was needed for weaponization. The genes that caused the plague's virulence were located on a plasma, and what he was describing would be a binary biological weapon where a benign bacterial plague cell would be mixed with the virulence-enhancing plasmid and immediately before loading it into a weapon. And then this infection of the plasmid into the organism would take place in a small bioreactor inside of the weapon itself. This would be a two-stage biological weapon. And in late 1992, shortly after Temple Fortune's defection, Dr. Katjan Abzalgov became the third defector from the Russian biological warfare program. And as deputy director, which would mean he was the number two man of Bioprepart, and an infectious disease physician and an epidemiologist, he was actually the highest-ranking defector ever to come from the program. In 1999, Abelak, who was the first defector, published Biohazard, which was a first-handed detailed account of his experiences. Abelak disclosed a virtual encyclopedia of intimate details on Bioprepart from the top down. And that would be personnel and facilities, history of offensive research, medical and microbiological discoveries, special production methods, weaponization techniques, aerosolized testing, and the Russian biological warfare defensive innovations, as well as prior deceptions, secret plans, and the future direction of the program. Yeah, I hope he looks over his shoulder at night. Abelak confided that the Soviet biologists in the 1960s and 70s were already interested in using genetics and gene manipulation. Diddling the 60s and the 70s, guys. We read about Fort Detrick back in 1977 to produce biological agents. In 1973, Leonard Brezhnev Leonid Brezhnev established the, quote, enzyme program to modernize the biological weapons program and develop genetically altered pathogens. Early in his career, Albalek had been in charge of developing Bioreparat's first vaccine-resistant tularemia bomblet, and later, by 1986, his team had also tripled the potency of the battle strain of anthrax, and I want to talk about that a little bit more in a minute, and that was called Strain 836. He was the very first to weaponize glanders and supervise the Soviet tests with Marburg virus, which is an Ebola-like virus that causes hemorrhagic fevers. And Albalek also disclosed that by 1992, the Russians possessed a grand total of 52 different biological agents or combinations of agents, including deadly Marburg, Ebola, smallpox viruses that could be weaponized. And most of the infectious and easiest to manufacture and transport microbes were labeled battle strains. And the favorite battle strains were anthrax, strain 836, Pasternak's super plague, and the Russian strain of tularemia. Albeck stated the Russian scientists had improved all three of these so that they could overcome all immune systems in current medical treatments. Now, how frightening is that? So now let's take a look at another paper I ran across. And this was titled, Former Soviet Biological Weapons Facilities in Kazakhstan, Past, Present, and Future. You know what? Yeah, maybe we go here first. There was another story out of Natural Blaze, which is Heather Callaghan's publication, titled The Pentagon's Bioweapons. We read this back in January. The U.S. Army regularly produces deadly viruses, bacteria, and toxins in direct violation of that very same U.N. Convention on the Prohibition of Biological Weapons. Hundreds of thousands of unwitting people are systematically exposed to dangerous pathogens and other incurable diseases. And biowarfare scientists using diplomatic cover to test man-made viruses at Pentagon biolaboratories in 25 countries across the world. These U.S. biolaboratories are funded by Defense Threat Reduction Agency, more affectionately known as DTRA, D-T-R-A, under a $2.1 billion military program called the Cooperative Biological Engagement Program, and are located in former Soviet Union countries such as Georgia and Ukraine, as well as the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and Africa. And it can go on and on and on. So let's pop over here. Former Soviet biological weapons facilities in Kazakhstan. Kazakhstani facilities involved in the research and development and production of biological weapons played a key role in the former, Soviet biological weapons program. And although a number of open publications have addressed the former Soviet program in recent years, few have examined the Kazakhstani portion of the system. This report provides the history of the Kazakhstani facilities and describes their current status and future prospects. So let's see where we go. In the early 1970s, the Soviet authorities began working on a new network of biological facilities, paralleling it to the military system. In 1972, the signed Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention, under which it was supposed to stop all offensive work. But this new civilian network of biotechnology institutes conducted some civilian research, but it also serves as a cover for a military-related biological weapons activity. These sites were formerly run by civilian authorities and involving a large number of civilian biotechnological specialists and enterprises, just like here. And in 1972, the USSR Council of Ministers established a secret interagency science and technology council on molecular biology and genetics, consisting of representatives from the Ministry of Defense, which and the Soviet Academy of Sciences, the Ministry of Health, and the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and Leonid Brezhnev at the time, who was the chairman of the USSR Council of Ministers. And the all-union Production Association Bioreparats was created in 1973 by a decree of the Central Committee of the USSR Council of Ministers and was tasked with implementing the programs approved by the interagency. All right, so I really don't care about the whole Soviet political system at the time. Just know it was still communist Russia. The wall had not come down yet. I'd be interested to see what Putin has been doing, though. And he has made some comments about he has weapons that would annihilate us. So now let's go. So it's established that there have been stuff developed in the USSR that was pretty damn dangerous. Now let's go to a few other things that I found that involved the United States. Here is one titled, Weaponized Mycoplasma Biowarfare, a Soft Kill Solution. The linking pathogen in neurosystemic diseases, they would include chronic fatigue, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis. Donald Scott is a retired high school teacher and a university professor who is currently the president of the Common Cause of Medical Research Foundation and an adjunct professor in the Institute of Molecular Medicine, which is immd.org, I believe, and there's a lot of good information out there. He has extensively researched neurosystematic degenerative diseases over the last five years and authored many documents on the relationship between degenerative diseases and pathogenic mycoplasmas called Mycoplasma fermentis. His research is based upon solid government evidence, and Donald Scott is also a veteran of World War II and was awarded the North Atlantic Star, the Burma Star with clasp, and the 1939 to 1945 Volunteer Service Medal and the Victory Medal as well. So he was part of World War II. And we know what was going on in deep, dark hallways during World War II. So part one, the mycoplasma. And I've come across this quite a bit in my research over the last few days, even digging into some of my own health problems. The mycoplasma, a common pathogenic mycoplasma. There are 200 species of mycoplasmas, and most of them are innocuous and do no harm. Only four of the five are pathogenic, and the mycoplasma fermentis, which is the incognita strain, and that is the strain that can get into every cell in your body without being seen and can mimic other diseases, probably comes from the nucleus of the Brucellosis bacteria. And that Brucellosis bacteria is one of the substances that we were tinkering with at Fort Detrick, Maryland, as a biowarfare item. This disease agent is not a bacteria, and it is not a virus. It is a mutated form of the Brucellosis bacteria, mutated via with a VISA virus from which the mycoplasma is extracted and then tinkered with. Dr. Maurice Hillman, chief virologist for the pharmaceutical company of Merck, ding, 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 and that was the same Merck that Merck was in charge of Fort Detrick, stated that this disease agent is now carried by everybody in North America. The silent pandemic, and possibly by most people throughout the world. The mycoplasma used to be very innocuous. Only one person out of 500,000 would get multiple sclerosis. One out of 300,000 would develop Alzheimer's, and one out of a million would develop Kruschev-Jacobs disease, and that's that CJD and CJVD. Before the early 80s, no one ever died of AIDS because it didn't exist. But the mycoplasma is the disease agent in AIDS, and we have the documentation to prove it. And that's come up in two different books that I have been reading. This mycoplasma actually destroys your immune system is what happens. Biowarfare research between 1942 and the present time, biological warfare research has resulted in a more deadly and infectious form of this mycoplasma, and they extracted this mycoplasma from the Brucellosis bacteria, then they weaponized it and actually reduced the disease to a crystalline form. According to Dr. Xing-Ching Lo, and he's the one that was tinkering with this in this other book I was reading called Project Daylily, it's the very same scientist, one of America's top researchers, This disease agent, the mycoplasma, causes, among other things, AIDS, chronic fatigue syndrome, multiple sclerosis, Wenger's disease, Parkinson's disease, Crohn's colitis, type 1 diabetes, and collagen vascular diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis and Alzheimer's. The mycoplasmas enter the individual cells of the body depending on your genetic disposition, and you may develop neurological diseases if the pathogen destroys certain cells in your brain, or you may develop Crohn's colitis if the pathogen invades and destroys your cells in the lower bowel. And once it gets into the cells, it can lie there doing nothing for sometimes like 10, 20, or 30 years. And if a trauma occurs, like an accident or a vaccination that does not take, like my one and only ever in my life flu vaccine that I got free in college because, I don't know, they convinced me that it was my duty because I lived in the dorms at the time. The mycoplasma can become triggered. Ding! And one of those, I found some crossover with this mycoplasma and Epstein-Barr virus, which was something that I had back at 15, and it can trigger that as well to mimic a lot of these things. And I think they may have even utilized mycoplasmas with Epstein-Barr. Or they used, actually, Harvard, something I sent Camille the other day. I found it in a book, a screenshot. Harvard had been producing mycoplasmas and or developing Epstein-Barr, something like that. But it all connects together. This is all weird tinkerings in the lab that they have done over the last 40 years. These mycoplasmas can become triggered. And because it is only the DNA particle of the bacteria, this mycoplasma does not have any organelles to process its own nutrients, so it only grows by uptaking perform steriles from its host cells, literally killing your cell after it invades it, and the cells rupture, and then it gets left dumped into the bloodstream. The conclusions of this author are entirely based upon official documents. 80% are United States or Canadian official government documents. 20% are articles from peer-reviewed journals, such as the Journal of American Medical Association, the New England Journal of Medicine, the Canadian Medical Association Journal as well. And these journal articles and government documents complement each other. They also have a document from Dr. Xingqing Lo, which names the mycoplasmas also as a cause of cancer. And Dr. Charles Engel, who is with the National Institute of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, stated at the National Institute of Health meeting February 7, 2000, quote, "I am now of the view that the probable cause of chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia is the mycoplasma." So the creation of the mycoplasma patent. Many doctors do not know about this mycoplasma because it was developed as part of the military in a biological warfare experimentation, and it was not made public. But I have a lot of that documentation here coming up if we can get there. This pathogenic mycoplasmic disease agent was patented by the U.S. military by very own Xingqing Lo, who was the very first top researcher for the Military Biological Warfare Research Facility. And I have that documented patent from the patent office, and I actually read that the other day. So here's one of the things. Now we're going to bounce over, so I do not run out of time. And I'm going to read an excerpt of a bunch of pages that I screenshotted so I could send over to Camille to show her this. Some of my research that I've been doing, it is all about mycoplasma, and it is out of the book called Project Daylily. It was a very unusual microorganism. It was not related to anthrax, which is the potent biowarfare agent that looks under a microscope like lines of a very small boxcar, and it can kill within a number of days if inhaled deep into the lungs at very low concentrations. The agent found by Dr. Lon was smaller than anthrax, and it contained much less genetic material, and it did not have the typical boxcar bacterial structure of anthrax. This unknown bug was to be examined, and it could no longer be alive for this process. It must be killed chemically and fixed with heavy metal atoms and bound to it, and then dehydrated in an alcohol and embedded in plastic in order to be cut into tiny, very thin slices so it can be viewed under an electron microscope. The electron microscope can magnify images hundreds of thousands of times and allow scientists to see minute details in biological structures. This instrument used was an electron beam microscope. And this beam, hold on, I got to click to different tabs, allowed Dr. Ming Long, who is considered a brilliant Chinese scientist, now working for the U.S. Army, to take a look at anthrax in his laboratory and at this new microorganism that was found in this culture from obtained from one of the German SS units retreating back to Germany from Eastern Europe. The Germans had been developing biological warfare agents for use in their killing programs in Eastern Europe, but they had not attempted to identify all of the organisms in their most potent cultures. It seems that the best isolates were mixtures of microorganisms, and Dr. Ming Long was assigned to determine just exactly what these deadly mixtures were. Dr. Long was old school Chinese, and his dress, demeanor, and polite conversational style were consistent with his mainland Chinese training. These men came to the electron microscopy lab to view this new potent organism that Dr. Lon had recently found under the electron microscope. And it goes in on how it happened. These three individuals were in a small dark room with the technician, and no one seemed to notice that the microscope that they were using was also made in Germany. Both Dr. Armwhite, a brigadier general in the U.S. Army Medical Corps, and Dr. Duchman, a scientist from the Pentagon, products of the Cold War, were in this room, and I don't care what they look like. This was out of a book, so it's kind of telling a story. It would have been the crowning achievement of an already distinguished career of this one-star general. Who would have ever thought that such a physician scientist could hold such a rank? However, this is a physician. He knew he must feign concern about his fellow man, especially for those who were ill and in need of a medical attention. He was a cruel political animal who used medicine as a tool to achieve his ambition, blah, 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 blah. He was a throwback to the fascist attitude world of the era of World War II, and one might have confused him with a stereotypical mad scientist from Hollywood B movies. Yes, the ones that I always imagine. And from his slight accent, one might have also concluded that Dr. Duchman was a paperclip scientist, one of the thousands of Nazi scientists brought over by the U.S. Army from the OSS after World War II. But in fact, his family emigrated from Germany to the United States generations ago. Dr. Min Long, by far, was the most intelligent of the trio, and he was trained both in China and the United States. He was considered a scientific genius in China and one of the best of the scientific generation, not like these arrogant others. He did, however, have a central flaw, and that was very common among scientists of his generation. He was incapable of resisting illegal and unethical orders from his superiors. Ding-a-ling. It was true in communist China, and it remains true in the capitalist United States. He was indebted to the U.S. government for getting him out of China, and he was not about to make the mistake of biting the hand that fed him. Dr. Lon smiled a lot in the company of more senior persons. It was a trait he had learned in China and could not seem to get rid of it. But his superiors actually liked it because that he showed that he was being subservient. Dr. Duchman was enthusiastically looking at the electron microscope. He says, "It is magnificent, just like a delicate petal of a glorious daylily." And that's what they decided to call it, was Project Daylily. "So beautiful for such a short time, then it vanishes from the garden. It is the perfect silent assassin, silent and untraceable." His voice had a mocking, sinister quality, as if he were eluding justice and getting away with it. "No one would ever think of a little mycoplasma and that it could be so deadly. They won't even be able to get a diagnosis on this one. The minute bug or mycoplasma, whose image they were looking at in the microscope, was a primitive form of bacterium. In fact, it was so primitive that it had lost its outer shell and its cell wall. And the little mycoplasma had also lost some of its genetic information, such as the genes that encode the thick cell wall and other genes that code for certain enzymes and metabolic pathways. It was smaller than most common bacteria and without the distinctive cell wall. It could also take on a variety of morphologies. It must hide inside of animals or humans to survive. And although originally thought to be fairly fragile, the little mycoplasma was hardier than anyone had ever imagined. And although it was considered primitive by bacteriological standards, it actually evolved from bacteria that contained cell walls, but along the way lost its ability to make its own cell wall. And made up for the loss of some of his genetic information by having evolved with other genetic sequences that allowed it to enter and colonize cells just like a virus. And although this little mycoplasma was first identified as a virus by Dr. Long, technically it was not a virus because it retained genetic and biochemical remnants of a bacteria. Like a virus, however, it damaged cells by interfering with some of the cell's biochemical cycles, and it encoded some nasty molecules that caused invaded cells to slowly self-destruct and die. It released metabolic products that damaged important cellular structures, and the important targets inside the cells were the mitochondria, which were the little organelles that likely evolved from a primitive system of microorganisms over millions of years, and they are called the power of the cells. Other targets of the mycoplasmas were the DNA or the genetic machinery found in each cell, which is crazy. Dr. Duchman said to his colleagues, this creature will hide inside cells and wreak unbelievable havoc. It'll destroy mitochondria, eventually sending cells into unrelenting death programs. And in the process of gene expression, it'll go crazy and surrounding cells will become damaged. This bug will then escape from the dying host cell and go to other places to colonize. It leaves its victims with an array of autoimmune symptoms similar to those found in various degenerative illnesses. It may even mimic some neurodegenerative diseases. It is beautiful because it should cause disease such as multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis, but no one will ever guess that they are caused by an infection. Most physicians are so stupid, they will never figure this out. And then if they do, they'll just go to the CDC. Or we'll just stick the CDC on them. What a delightful weapon. Dr. Ming Long has been patiently listening. And he was considered a scientific idiot. So there we go, guys. Check out Mycoplasma. Catch up with you next week. Everybody take care.